Thanks, Jacob. It's great to be back. I always feel kind of like I'm at home when I'm here, which actually I think says something about the institution, because every time I'm here, I'm talking about something else, and yet it still feels really, really great to be here. So this is kind of, for me, the fun talk. You're catching me in the middle of a six-month book tour, and I'm talking about this book, God vs. Gay. And the book is you know, kind of like an inclusion book, right? Here's why the majority of our shared Jewish and Christian religious values support inclusion of sexual and gender minorities rather than oppose them. And that's great, and I chose to write that book, and it's a book aimed at the movable middle, and it's been really moving and heartwarming going around the country and talking about it. But it's not my edge, and it's probably not your edge. I was reminded of the last line of Portnoy's complaint, right? Philip Roth, right? So he spends 200 pages spewing out all of his neurosis, sexual neuroses, which is a good summary of the last 20 years of organizational Jewish life, 40 years. And then finally his therapist says at the end, right, very well, now we may perhaps begin, right? I feel that's right where we're at on issues of LGBT folks in the wider Jewish community. Maybe not at the beginning, but close to it. Like, I think we're now just at a place where we get to ask more interesting questions than what about Leviticus, or how do we make synagogues welcoming and institutions welcoming? Not that those, A, aren't important questions, and B, aren't still live questions, right? You know, it's like we still have glass ceilings regarding women in every major Jewish organizations, and there's still glass closets, maybe I'll coin that phrase, glass closets around LGBT folks in many of our communal institutions. So it's not like that battle is over, right? But in a way, that's the part I wanna get over at some point, hopefully, because the really exciting stuff is what I'm gonna talk about now. The really exciting stuff is what's yet to come. And just by way of a parallel, I'll stick with kind of the feminism parallel. So I came of age really in the late 80s, I guess. You know, I'm 40 years old now. And so feminist theology had worked its way through and flourished a lot, I think, by the time I was already encountering Jewish theology in general in a sophisticated way. And I can't imagine my Jewishness, let alone my Jewish theology, without the contributions of feminism and feminist theology, even though I don't identify as a woman, right? Perhaps that's an obvious point, but I'm not sure we're at exactly the same kind of place in the analogy on LGBT issues, right? That I think the insights of sexual and gender minorities and the perspectives and the contributions and the changes and the agitations are of interest to everybody. And that the entire community is already benefiting, I think, from perspectives and voices which had previously been excluded and marginalized. And that, to me, is really exciting. And so that is what I want to talk a little bit about today. I want to start, actually, with setting up a structure, a spectrum. I'm just finishing my dissertation right now on Jacob Frank, who's this kind of Jewish-Christian syncretizer heretic figure. So everything's in threes in my mind. It's a lot of trinities everywhere I go. So there's a structure I want to suggest of three modes of relationship between LGBT people and religious communities that I think is a useful frame. The first is what I've just mentioned about inclusion. Right, kind of knocking on the door. This is what, like, the work around God versus Gay, right? We being LGBT folks, should be fully included in religious structures, religious communities, and in ritual, and in, you know, be full human beings, basically, right? And inclusion, kind of an assimilationist model, a little bit more like HRC, Human Rights Campaign, and less like the Radical Fairies, let's say, right? So we're kind of, you know, we're not going to destroy or disturb even the dominant religious structure. We just want to be incorporated into it. And, you know, two lesbians holding hands in shul should not be earth-shatteringly wild and crazy. Like, this is, you know, this is not a big deal, right? Kind of an inclusion model. I think a second phase along the way is what I'm mostly going to focus on today, which is more about transformation and less about inclusion. Right? So querying and queering theological traditions, Midrash, Bible, liturgy, right? So actually saying, well, great, thanks for letting us in the door. Now that we're here, we're actually going to change things, right? Because actually, we'll take a look at this ridiculously heteronormative discourse that you're participating in. Not only is it patriarchal and sexist, but it's also beyond, it's like homophobic, it's gender diversity phobic, and they're all kind of, and the gender binary is problematic, and queering the tradition, transforming the tradition, right? So less about inclusion, more about transformation. And noticing that that move can actually be exactly sort of counter, like it cross purposes with the first one, right? The first one is let us in, we're not gonna change anything. And the second is now we're gonna change everything, Right? And again, I take a lesson from the progress of feminism in the Jewish community over a long period of time. I just want to give voice to a third kind of piece, and which is actually less about inclusion and transformation and more about rejection or constructing an alternative to the existing structures. So not even transforming the existing structures, but saying, and rejection is actually a little too strong of a word, but I wanted something that ended in T-I-O-N, so I'm happy to, if you come up with a new one, I'll change it. So finding alternatives, different structures. This could be as simple as creating new Jewish spaces. Right, so again, taking an analogy from issues of gender, maybe like Kohenet, the Jewish Priestess Institute, recovering kind of suppressed traditions, inventing new ones, and creating new spaces for Jewish women to do ritual together. Right, that's not really a rejection, but it's constructing an alternative kind of a space or a location. Or it could look like in the gay male community, the gay spirituality movement, which attempts to draw on indigenous traditions and create some kind of in an imaginaire. Or it could look like paganism, or it could look like queer theory as praxis. Right, it's creating queer spaces where the Jewish pieces may or may not inform, but they're alternatives too. They're not even trying to transform the existing structures. Right, and the reason I start with this kind of schematic is I think it's helpful to kind of tease apart the tendencies, because obviously any one sentence could have all three tendencies, to kind of tease apart those different tendencies and see in which they flow. Most of what I'd like to talk about for the next little while is on number two, on transformation. And I'm going to use the classic Jewish formulation of God, Torah, and Israel, because it's a convenient one. And I'm mostly going to start with Israel, actually, because, of course, if you're querying something, you always have to turn it upside down. So Israel, Torah, and God. But noticing that throughout what I'd like to say about those three topics, there's a momentum towards rejection, a momentum towards transformation, or a momentum towards inclusion, and they're fighting against one another. They're complicated. So just by one example, I demand and request full inclusion in not only all Jewish spaces, but all United States civic spaces and civic rights, even as I think a lot of them are terrible, and I want to critique them and say that I actually have some privileged position in which to critique them. Right? So I want to have my marriage cake and eat it too. Right? I want to critique heteronormativity and existing structures and get the privileges that in New York I have because now I'm married to my same-sex partner. Right? So noting that there are contradictions and complexities even within taking a single position, and just kind of saying that at the outset. So I mentioned there's going to be a lot of trinities. So under Israel, Torah, and God, I want to mention three points under each. And of course, since there are three, that's very convenient. And I've just done the introduction, and now this is like the center part, and then there's the conclusion. So it's all an elaborate spinozistic kind of Christological structure. So here's one of the first questions that folks learn doing coalition building and any kind of anti-oppression work, which is, who is the we? Right? Who's the we that we are claiming to speak for? Who's the we that we're including? Who's the we that we're excluding? Right? When we say we, what do we mean? So I learned this actually in, was it Columbia or high school even? Right? Two sentences. All men are created equal. All men like to pee standing up. Right? The same word includes and excludes their different we's, right? Different, there's kind of a pun in there. There's different populations. There's different populations that are included and excluded even through the, so if I say we feel this, or we progressive Jews feel that, or we progressives say that, right? So I'm assuming and creating and constituting a we. So who's the we of Israel, right? In the God, Torah, and Israel? Who are my ancestors? Who are the people from whom I draw sustenance? I actually owe a lot in this actually to Rabbi Jill Hammer. I mentioned Kohenet, which is her project that she co-founded with Holly Scher. And a lot of what Kohenet's about is assuming that if something's being banned by the priestly elite and the folks who wrote the Bible, that means Israelites were doing it, right? So who's the we, right? Precisely that which is forbidden in the starkest terms by those who are doing the forbidding may actually be the most fertile grounds for recovering a different kind of Israelite Jewish identity. Whether that's Avodah Zarah, which was never really quite as Zarah as the biblical writers would like us to believe, right? It was never really as foreign as it was made to seem, right? Or even the whole construction of Israelite identity as against Canaanite identity, which archaeological evidence suggests was more of a literary construction than anything resembling national or ethnic or racial, to even a more anachronistic term, lines. So who's this we, and why, and what's the kind of queer angle in particular? Well, first, I think there's something important about the experience of oppression. Hopefully, and this has never really worked in practice, hopefully heightening our attention to other oppressions, right? So as a member of a marginalized group, I'm particularly sensitive, hopefully, to marginalization. We've seen that this does not actually work in practice, but I think it could work in theory, right? We've seen this, perhaps you may have noticed in the good gay community, the HRC gay community, a fair amount of transphobia, a fair amount of sexism, a fair amount of unprocessed stuff. Human Rights Campaign, which is an organization I work with actually a lot, so that's why I can bash them. I teach for them, just honored Goldman Sachs as their recipient of their corporate award at their gala in New York. This suggests a lack of sensitivity to who is the we. And it was all about, actually, it became clear 2 days later when the president, the head of Goldman Sachs, announced this big corporate drive for marriage equality, national marriage equality. So this was actually kind of a quid pro quo. Nonetheless, I actually, typical Jay Michelson move, I was both at the protests outside the HRC gala, and then I went into the HRC gala. So hopefully there's some notion of taking a position, choosing an interpretive position that reflexively and hopefully in a self-aware way sides with those who are being oppressed and marginalized rather than those who are doing the marginalizing. So that's as true as when I read about Balak and Balaam as it is when I read about things that are particularly sexualized. Certainly it's true, hopefully for most of us, whose side do we take on the story of Pinchas? You know, do we take the side of the people running the swords through the sexual deviance, or do we take the side of the sexual deviance? Right, so there's hopefully something about the position of the oppressed that should enable a rereading of queer biblical text through a different kind of a lens. Second, sexuality itself was exactly one of the ways in which boundaries were drawn, were constituted. Right, so if we understand the prohibitions on sacred prostitution in terms of avodah zarah and boundary drawing, if, as I do in my inclusion work, I understand the rules about homosexuality or male sexual intimacy in the context of drawing boundary lines between Israelites and Canaanites, then we actually see as queer folks and allies that those who are kind of liminal or boundary crossing, whether it's crossing genders or effacing gender lines, or whether it's crossing national lines or effacing some of those lines, are actually on the wrong side, not only of the us-them boundary, but the wrong side of the whole notion of drawing an us-them boundary. So the Levitical boundaries, I think, are boundaries about boundaries, right? They're boundaries that are created to draw, that we draw boundaries around pure and impure, boundaries around Israelite and Canaanite, and by drawing those boundaries, this is drawing from Ken Stone's work. If everyone hasn't read Practicing Safer Texts yet, I strongly recommend it. It's a fantastic book. Plus, it's got a funny title. These are boundaries about boundaries, and yet it precisely in two very different forms of kind of contemporary discourse, whether it's queer theory on the one hand or kind of gay spirituality on the other hand, there's a notion of third gender folks or people questioning the gender binaries in terms of gender performance, right, as problematizing what should be obviously problematized already, which is the construction of those very boundaries, right? The drawing of the boundary is itself what makes us us in a certain way and what makes them them. And the transgression of that boundary could be a really productive way to kind of question, well, is that actually the way, like, the boundaries that we want to be necessarily drawing? Right? Now, of course, queering boundaries within the Jewish tradition is more radical than probably most of us might be willing to, right? I mean, if Judaism is about anything, surely it's about boundaries, right? Sacred time, secular time, permitted, forbidden, boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. The whole religion is one of boundaries. And I think in a religion of civilization, boundary drawing is a constitutive act. So it's not like we're doing away with boundaries. But some notion of questioning boundaries could be extremely helpful, which is why I think actually there's been such an interesting resurgence in mysticism, spirituality, kind of boundary destroying or boundary effacing practices within progressive, not just Jewish context, but within progressive Jewish context. So first, something about queer oppression and oppression generally. Second, that sexuality is actually one of the places where those boundaries are drawn. And third, questioning the entire Levitical project, even as that project is the one that I want to be included into. Right? So back into that dynamic between transformation and inclusion, recognizing that wanting to be part of the us while questioning the value of having an us and a them, an in-group and an out-group, right, is itself a kind of a contradiction. But it's a contradiction that there's a really fantastic essay by Virginia Raimi Mollenkott. I'm going to cite as many queer theologians as I can to just get the names written on notes and pieces of paper if you haven't read some of these folks, who wrote Reading the Bible from Low and Outside, which kind of critiques the gay narrative of coming out, right? Remember, we used to be told that coming out is the thing that all gay people have to do, come out, come out, come out. Actually critiquing that from a sort of noticing power relationships kind of perspective, right? So actually looking within biblical texts for numerous examples of characters who choose to be either, you could use the term closeted or you could use the term stealth if you prefer, who kind of choose to disclose and not to disclose. And the choice of not to disclose is actually sometimes a very sophisticated way of addressing a power imbalance. And in case that sounds too academic, I think we take a step back into the world outside. We're not really in an ivory tower, I guess, because kind of, we're sort of on ground level, but somehow outside these windows, where LGBT youth homelessness has gone up rather than down in the last couple of years. And the data that we have is that this is happening because kids are coming out earlier and they're being thrown out in family situations that the family's not, you know, often in religious context. And these kids are ending up on the street, they're ending up in sex work, they're ending up in very high-risk situations. And it's one of the issues, particularly in New York, where hopefully this big, nice, broad coalition which we brought together around marriage equality will now be equally enthusiastic around LGBT youth homelessness and about also a trans-inclusive Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which is what's on the agenda right now in New York. Interesting question, back to that thing of does having a position of the oppressed actually heighten your sensitivity to more oppression or not? So far, the queer youth of color who are on the streets in New York, not actually resonating so much with the Park Avenue donors to some of the large gay organizations. But of course, they should be. So arguably, this whole rhetoric of come out wherever you are, is actually a naive rhetoric. And that just as I think one of the great metaphors that this is mostly a gay and lesbian experience, has given to all of us has been this metaphor of coming out, right? I mean, all of us have closets in which we're hiding, maybe by choice or maybe not. All of us have opportunities for coming out. It's one of those kind of nice metaphors that I think is now part of the common culture, right? As true as that is, it's also a sort of naive, kind of not so power sensitive analysis of when it's right to come out and when it's not right to come out, when it's safe and when it's not safe. And so it's not necessarily when I go through the Bible and looking for who's the we and who's the Israelites that I focus necessarily always on David and Jonathan, right? I mean, it's nice David and Jonathan and Ruth and Naomi, and I'll talk about them in a minute, but it might actually be characters who are marginalized in any number of different ways and who choose to not disclose. You know, you can think about Queen Esther, for example, in the Purim story, choose to not disclose as a means of affecting the change that they want to affect, or choose, as in the case of Queen Esther, a particularly dramatic diva moment in which to disclose, right? I mean, she really, right, not even the first banquet, the second banquet, right? So really creating the conditions in which it might actually be safe for that disclosure to be made. And so this form, I think, of queering Israel takes place, whether it's in queer midrash, filling in some of the missing or silenced stories. Andrew Raymer has a great book called Queering the Text, which it's like everybody in the Bible has some queer brother, sister, or sibling, actually, and they found their way into his new book of midrash. Or, you know, it's almost like we're not even standing again at Sinai. We're standing again at some other mountain entirely and wondering who wasn't even allowed to be at Sinai at all. In that, you know, who are the people in the valley, or who are the people in the high places who had their idols destroyed by the righteous kings, which our tradition tends to applaud? And this, for me, is very much a lived phenomenon. This kind of queering of Israel, or querying of Israel, and deciding or being selective with where the ancestors are that I kind of want to, that I see when I kind of would like to, when I look in the rosy mirror. The ideal mirror, which is what I think these mythic ancestors provide. So three suggestions on what it might look like to queer Torah in the broad sense, in the sense of learning. I think the first three are kind of they're all on content. I'm going to kind of differentiate. I'm not too keen on this distinction because there's only two instead of three, but it's about content and form. For me, actually, the most important querying of Torah that I have done over the last 15 years or so has been affirming the reality and importance of love and of pleasure in our thinking about what it is to learn, to be, and to live as a human being. I think all of us, everyone, and by everyone I really mean everyone, should have the journey of affirming the truth of one's own intimacy and love as a sacred space and sacred act. But I think that to be an affirming religious LGBT person, you have to. Not only that you should, but that you must. And for me, this actually is something that I'm still working with now. I'm still very much where some of my edge is in determining how much I even want to participate in a tradition or that seeks to regulate pleasure according to external norms as opposed to some other way. In a tradition which still is ambivalent around bodies and not so ambivalent around some people's bodies, actually pretty clearly not ambivalent. Let me quote Carter Hayward, another queer theologian. "I'm attempting to give a voice to an embodied, sensual, relational movement among," this is her language, "among women and men who experience our sexualities as a liberating resource and who, at least in part through this experience, have been strengthened in the struggle for justice for all." Maybe I'll read that again. "I'm attempting to give voice to an embodied, sensual, relational movement among women and men who experience our sexualities as a liberating resource." So not experiencing the sexuality as a conundrum to be somehow harmonized with what's right, but sexuality itself as the resource for liberation. "And through that experience have been strengthened in the struggle for justice for all." Or I'll quote Audre Lorde, right? "The uses of the erotic as power." If anyone has not read the relatively short essay by Audre Lorde, the uses of the erotic, please download it on your mobile device right now and read it instead of listen to what I have to say. It should absolutely be on every, not just rabbinical school curriculum, but every school of theology. I don't think anyone should be able to be a clergy member without reading Audre Lorde. So this is just a couple of sentences. "There are many kinds of power, used and unused, acknowledged or otherwise. The erotic is a resource within each of us, firmly rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. In order to perpetuate itself, every oppression must corrupt or distort those various sources of power within the culture of the oppressed that can provide energy for change. For women," this is Audre Lorde writing, "right? For women, this has meant a suppression of the erotic as a considered source of power and information within our lives." Let me read one sentence of that again. "In order to perpetuate itself, every oppression must corrupt or distort those various sources of power," and notice the plurality there, "within that culture of the oppressed that can provide energy for change." To me, this is actually the best way I understand polytheism versus monotheism in a positive light, right? That there are multiple sources of power, of energy and of information within each of us, and that in order to maintain any kind of oppression, those sources have to be delegitimized. Because there's an anarchy of multiplicity of desires and of sources for power. Since Jacob gave a shout out to my poetry, I'll give a shout out back to his poem, Golden Calf, which takes the position of the people who are celebrating some sort of ecstatic ritual and not really so interested in Moses coming down and telling them how things are supposed to be. So 2 days ago, I was in Vassar. And I don't know if you've had how many of you have had the opportunity to engage really conservative Catholics in ideological argument. There's a particularly Catholic strain of conservatism, which is different from a lot of other ones, which has usually a lot to do with objective values and objective truth. And as soon as you get rid of my objective values, you must be a moral relativist because there could never be objective values other than mine. I was accused of being a moral relativist. And I kind of said, well, actually, I don't think it's moral relativism to say that love is important, that it's a value, that intimacy is important. I mean, I cite Genesis 2:18 a lot. It's not good for the human being to be alone. You could pick a lot of other sources, right? I don't think that's relative. I think that's a real value. But in a certain way, he's right, because it is relative insofar as we each have our own different desires and we each have our own different loves, right? There is a sort of revolutionary, not to glorify it too much, momentum or power, as I think Audre Lorde is talking about, within desire itself. So I certainly on my own, like in my own kind of journey, that's not how I understood sexuality. For my sexuality, it's not how I understood gender either. It was definitely, oh my gosh, how do I figure out how to put this in a container? But notice that anytime there's that anxiety around putting something in a container, there must be some power there that's being harnessed or that's being contained. Okay. Second notion of what it might mean to queer Torah has to do with just the recognition that all categories and assumptions are ultimately constructed and thus ultimately insufficient. right? That no map is going to be territory. And part of this is just, again, having new categories of experience that weren't there before. What would it be like to adapt notions of gender and gender transition to different forms of transition in our lives and in our identities? How does that get translated into a religious idiom? Or thinking about the functions of gender binarism in ritual and halakha and social life, any time where we see the kind of set of categories that seem to be preset, obviously those are the categories that are being constructed and imposed. So sometimes those categories serve us and sometimes they don't. It's not a rejection of every category. But just noticing that immediately, just from the recognition that categories are constructed, already, I mean, I had another good queer theologian I'll mention is Noach Zemura, who wrote a book called, or edited a book called Balancing on the Mechitza, Transgender in the Jewish Community, which just won a Lambda Literary Award, actually. Noach and I had an extended argument in Tikkun, where I took the more conservative side. And Noach said, basically, if we don't get rid of the gender binary in Judaism, everything else is just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. All of the problems, all of the oppression, it all comes from the gender binary. And I responded like, Noach, if we can only make progress by taking apart the gender binary, we're stuck. I mean, this is a really important binary. Like, it's, yes, I don't like the gender binary, but it's in the language, right? It's really hard. So, you know, it's sort of a radical versus liberal argument. Now I want to make Noach's argument a little bit more, sort of make the radical argument. But just sort of noticing that even just something as simple, I think, kind of philosophically as questioning categories and questioning binaries, I mean, we do that all the time, probably. But if we take it seriously, it actually is a radical potential for radical critique or a radical rewriting or rethinking. Not just about having egalitarian spaces, but really actually and not even having egalitarian God language or goddess language, but actually rethinking this fundamental ordering principle that's within our religious and our legal traditions. Third, and hopefully to give a little bit of levity, there's something wonderful, I think, about the camp and trickster sensitivity and sensibility that comes in most queer engagements with religious tradition. I'll give an example. Let me contrast people who I call Orthodox pagans and the radical fairies. Rather than even explain this, I'll just sort of give the anecdote. So I was at Burning Man with some friends. So the radical fairies are anti-assimilationist queer people, mostly male-bodied people, but not entirely, who kind of felt that the revolutionary power of the gay liberation movement in 1969, 70, 71, 72 kind of got co-opted by the HRCs of the world, by the discos of the world, by the clones of the world, and it became sort of just either an assimilationist movement or a hedonistic movement when actually it had the potential to be a revolutionary spiritual movement. So I was with someone who was at Stonewall, my friend Donald, and he has now a long white beard, which he usually dyes different colors, and he's a very playful personality. And we were at Burning Man, which has all kinds of different things going on. And we actually went to way out in the open desert. There was a little fire circle that some pagans, self-identified pagans, were running. And so we got there, and we're so happy. We're going to dance around the fire. But then we got there, and we were instructed that we had to not dance, but walk in a clockwise direction. We were not allowed to stand still. There was not going to be any of this kind of dancing. And so I was kind of not sure how to process this information. Donald was very sure how to process this information, which is that he just started laughing, dancing merrily, going counterclockwise, right? There's something wonderful, I think, about not taking our religious traditions too seriously, especially if they're actually supposed to be the opposition to the dominant, bad, patriarchal religions. But wherever we are in spiritual religious traditions, not taking them too seriously. And I think a sense of irony around Jewish practice is always really helpful. And that irony can come from being a Jewish woman, right? And seeing like, well, yeah, I'm participating in this practice despite thousands of years of this practice being used to oppress me and people like me, right? It can come from a position of being LGBTQ, right? It can come from a number of different positions. But just having that little bit of irony, I think, is the difference. It's hard to be ironic and I'm trying to find a synonym for fascistic, you know. It's hard to be ironic and intensely nationalistic, jingoistic, and ethnocentric at the same time, right? It's just hard to do. I mean, I'm sure you could figure out a way, but it's hard to do. Generally, those kinds of tight ethnocentrism come from an excess of sincerity, not an excess of irony. So in terms of forms, for me, this kind of queering of Torah takes place in queer midrash, queer parshanut, in halakha, obviously in liturgy, reading David and Jonathan in the context of warrior love. And actually, I'd like to recover Ruth and Naomi for the third or fourth time, right? So I think the first move to recover Ruth and Naomi was like the sort of think of like, oh, great, look, same-sex partners in the Bible. This is great. Yay. And then there's a kind of closer reading of like, well, is that really right? Does that really do justice to Ruth and Naomi's experience? But I actually read a really old essay just last year, which completely changed my mind. Adrienne Rich's essay, Compulsory Heterosexuality and Lesbian Existence, which I hadn't read before, so mea culpa for not having read that before, which totally reinterpreted for me how I understood actually Ruth and Naomi. I mean, Rich's point is basically like, we shouldn't be looking for genital contact between women and making sure, and that's what counts as lesbianism, and if it's not that, that's not it. And right, what we should be looking for are relationships and situations that are created outside of what she terms compulsory heterosexuality, which in that case, I think Ruth and Naomi definitely did, actually. And actually reopened looking at a lot of different relationships within biblical sources and later, in ways that were profoundly liberating for me to actually kind of think, well, why go gay hunting when it's much more productive to actually see, well, these are nexuses and places of relationship that are just constructing themselves outside of the dominant kind of here's what the form is. And that's profoundly liberating because that's stuff we do today. And that's actually how we can find our ancestors, I think, much more than gay hunting. Is he or isn't he? You know, I wrote an article this year called Queering Kabbalistic Gender Dimorphism. It's a bestseller on Amazon. Not really. And part of the discussion was, you know, well, oh, there are all these all male fellowships and they leave their wives behind. You know, does that mean they were doing it? You know, the circle of the RE and stuff? Well, that's, first of all, no, but that's a ridiculous question, right? I mean, it's to me so much more interesting to think of like the work that Naomi Seidman has done on the sort of eroticism of same-sex relationships in Eastern Europe and the de-eroticization of marriage, of opposite sex. Like, they're beautiful, powerful love poems between men that are not sexual, right? And you don't see a whole lot of heterosexual love poetry with that level of intensity. That to me is much more interesting than reducing sexuality and gender to who's doing what with whom and what body parts are going where. So finally, some notion about God. The first piece I want to suggest about queering God is a general critique of this whole notion of God. I'd kind of like to get rid of the word God. As we know, it's not really a Jewish word, but in particular, there's every time I say the word, I want to critique the masculinity of it, even if I change the pronouns in liturgy. But more than that, I want to really question or queer the notion of triumphalism and of hierarchy and of the whole sky god worship of a sky god. I mean, sometimes I like sky gods. I sometimes like to have it. There was a teacher we had at Nehirim named Chaim Obadia. He gave a session called Who's Your Daddy? About wanting a really strong daddy figure to kind of punish you when you did wrong and things like that. And that's kind of where he's at. And there's plenty of that imagery. They're great resources for that in the Tanakh. And that's great. That's fine. But just the whole notion, right, sort of building on a certain kind of masculinity, which maybe the tradition never even took seriously itself. So in that article I mentioned before about queering Kabbalah, you know, Kabbalah is tricky, right? Because on the one hand, it's been recovered by feminists and others as like, here's an alternative to the bad Jewish mainstream discourse. On the other hand, it's at least as misogynistic, certainly heteronormative, and certainly as ethnocentric, if not more so, than the mainstream to which it's supposedly an alternative. So I'm all in favor of neo-Hasidism and neo-Kabbalah just taking the good parts and throwing out the bad parts. That's fine. But as scholars, which I think maybe that's part of the we here as well, we have to be ambivalent about that kind of a recovery, because it's even when it's doing that, it's recovering traditions outside of a context that itself is deeply problematic. So great, Shekhinah, bring her on. That's great, right? But also, at least with that sense of irony, at least, understanding that the way that the Shekhinah is frequently portrayed relative to the other Sfirot is not actually quite so liberating, right? She's just a vessel. She's just like the moon. She just reflects the light of the sun. And being sort of a complex reappropriation of some of this Kabbalistic symbolism. In that article, actually, I try to engage with Elliot Wolfson's argument that The dominant trend in Theosophical Kabbalah is one of absorption and erasure of the feminine entirely. And I think he actually overstates the case a little bit. Other scholars have pointed out that there are plenty of sources which that's not true. So, for example, there are descriptions of the mystic merging with the divine, like a person drowning in the sea, and that's been feminized in a certain way. So that's a feminine metaphor that's not absorption of the feminine, but absorption of the masculine within the feminine. But aside from that, just this, I think the whole kind of construction of gender itself within certain Kabbalistic texts actually does have the potential to be somewhat liberating, right? The notion that the manly man and the girly girl, or Popeye and olive oil, doesn't actually represent the multi-gendered deity of the Kabbalah is really helpful. The notion that the completed phallus is only a circumcised phallus, and it's only a phallus with negative space inscribed upon it, actually I think is profoundly liberating for how we even understand the phallocentrism of the Kabbalah. It's only the feminized phallus that is ability to be receptive to prophecy. That the very word Kabbalah means receiving. That this is a discourse by men, for men, telling them how to be more receptive. Now, their understanding, their gendering of receptiveness might not be my choice of how I would want to gender receptiveness is always feminine, but that is how they understand it. So the whole discourse is one of teaching men how to feminize themselves. In their set, right? Again, with that irony, with that recognition that I don't want to buy into that gender essentialism. I don't want to make that claim. Okay, so some kind of notion of recovering traditions or inventing traditions within the Jewish tradition, which critique the very masculinity that they sometimes seek to reaffirm. Second and third are going to be about yesh and ayin. The second being about the via positiva. This is actually, I think, the only point I'm making from my book, which is that if God loves everything, God loves anything, God loves diversity, right? Whatever, when we look at the natural world, surely diversity, right, biodiversity, gender diversity, sexual diversity, including homosexuality and animal species, but more importantly, including the wide variety of fractal diversity that's everywhere around us, right? That there's a radical diversity that should be mirrored in our community structures and in our projections onto the divine as well, right? The idea of the Godhead and genders fluctuating among the Sefirot, and the idea of balancing of what we would term good and evil rather than the vanquishment of evil, that the left included in the right does mean an incorporation of the shadow within the whole. These are notions which seem to have a richer flavor around diversity to them than, I don't know, other resources we might select in the Jewish tradition. And there, in this case, I find there are actually a lot of resources within the mystical tradition that I find profoundly liberating, precisely because of this seeming reincorporation of what might be termed theological polymorphism. If you don't want to call it polytheism, that's okay. I get it. It's a rabbinical school still. Theological polymorphism, if not polytheism, within a monotheistic frame. And that for me is actually deeply liberating. And as an aside, just to tie some of my other work in here, it's precisely those traditions around the world which are the most monistic, all is one, everything is God, that also are the most polymorphous in their depictions of the deity. So I think about Hinduism, for example, in Vedanta, where the sort of radical Advaita Vedanta, that everything is the one and that you don't exist as a separate being, exists alongside perhaps the most and I say this in a very positive way, florid polytheistic traditions anywhere in the world. And likewise in the Zohar, where the Zohar is saying over and over again, kula chada, kula chada, kula chada, at the same time as replicating complexity within the divine in a way never before seen in Jewish religious tradition. So it's not that the via positiva is somehow polytheistic. It's precisely those traditions which are monistic which tend to favor theological polymorphism. And then finally, there is this notion of ayin, right, of negative theology, or the via negativa, that queer theology is basically negative theology because any ascription is human and contingent. Any category, any projection, and here I think of some of the work that's been done on Derrida and negative theology. There's been a lot of good work on that. And through via Derrida and postmodernism through into some of the current writings on queer theory, right? That any projection of any category is in and of itself insufficient, and that this is another of the many ways in which this is reaffirmed is through our understanding of gender diversity and sexual diversity in our own lives or in the lives of our communities. It's yet another way in which to embody, literally embody, the contradictions of supposed categories, which can't capture the complexity of experience. And here, when it comes to theology and it comes to God in particular, there is so much work to do. We are so far behind in queer theology. There is not none, there is some, and it's great. But we are way behind our Christian sisters, brothers, and siblings when it comes to this. Because, you know, we're generally behind the Christian theology anyway, right? Theology, the whole thing is Christian, right? So who cares about Jewish theology? Well, we care about Jewish theology, right? If no one else does, you know, the we that's in this room is supposed to care. And there are such wonderful, rich resources in Christian queer theology that they should inspire those of us who are interested in these issues to see how they play in the Jewish context. What I had intended to do at this moment was actually avalanche you in just a huge pile of names, but I'm not going to do that. Although it is kind of Kabbalistic to do that, just recite the names and you'll hear the sounds and something will happen. But they're in the book. But they're also, you know, this is a tradition that can be deeply empowering and nourishing. And some of the most exciting work that I know of is being done in this area. Maybe it is just because, you know, it resonates with me, but I think it's because it's just really deeply urgent and powerful work. So let me offer just a couple of concluding thoughts, and then we will have time for questions, conversation, etc. Anytime I see a discourse of here's what's special about being X, there is a shadow discourse of here's why I have to justify X, right? So I think in any attempt to bring to bear queer perspectives, multiple queer perspectives on God, Torah, and Israel, or on any other categories, we should be wary of unconsciously importing the shadow discourse of why did God make me gay, or justifying my existence, or here's why it's not so bad after all, or here's why it's not a conundrum. Implicit in the notion of here are contributions and here are things to be added is some notion that of like, well, okay, good thing we have that because that justifies why you're here in the first place. Barney Frank has a great line that he says, I fought all my life for the right to be boring. And I want to affirm that as I have not fought all my life for the right to be boring, I hope, not on a conscious level anyway. But I want to affirm that as also a perfectly valid path. It's not like there's some sort of, you know, actually, there's a really fun little article just came out. I don't know how many people are aware, but one of the things, particularly in the gay male community, there's been a lot of literature about Native American traditions, which have very positive valences for gender variant people we might call LGB or T. Different traditions have different names for these. There's a European colonial word, burdash, which actually is a French word. It's a colonial word. It's also kind of it's like Murano. It's not actually such a nice word. So the modern word that's being used, the contemporary word, I should say, is the word two-spirit, right? That people have male and female spirit within them. And not every tribe, actually, not every tradition values these people, but many do. They're seen as anomalies, and that's seen as important or interesting or somehow transgressive in a positive way, that the notion of transgressing a boundary doesn't always have to be the Levitical boundaries, right? That's what shamans do all the time. They cross boundaries between this world and other worlds. And so this transgressing of boundaries that two-spirit people do in a way puts them in a position to be able to transgress other boundaries in spiritual ways. It also removes them, it tends to remove them from social, from the traditional social obligations and gives them different social roles. So I just read an article, just got published in a new book by someone who is Native American living in San Francisco, saying he's really tired. I'll just say it the way he does, even though this is being recorded. These are his words. He said, I don't want to be two-spirited. I just want to get laid, right? Like, he's tired of meeting these white guys who constantly want him to be spiritual because he's Native American and two-spirited, and isn't that great? And you have all these great resources in your tradition, and you must be so proud. And he's like, actually, I'm just trying to meet somebody just like you are. And right, so anytime, this is my way of undermining everything I've said for the last 45 minutes. Anytime there's any attempt to say, well, here are some interesting contributions of this or that group, we can just kind of re-essentialize even when we're trying not to re-essentialize and justify even when we're not trying to justify. This is about how the diverse conditions of all of our lives enrich all of our lives. And for me, it is actually a really exciting kind of conversation to have. I want to end actually with a, given some of what I've said over the last few minutes, with what may seem like a very conventional kind of ending point. But it might actually help ground some of what I've said in lived experience. I talked a little bit about, I think the first thing I mentioned under Torah was validating the importance of love as a resource and power, and sexuality as a resource for power and for understanding and for accessing truth. That this is one of the sources of, you might call it revelation, but certainly it's one of the sources of truth. I think actually what the story that I've told probably now 40 or 50 times actually on the book tour comes from Huckleberry Finn, from Mark Twain's Huck Finn, which, by the way, for folks who are a little bit older in the room, when I speak to college students, half of them have not read Huck Finn. It's like not on the high school curriculum the way it used to be, which I think is really a shame. Just pass that on. But so Huck Finn, where Huck is floating down the river with Jim, right? And he's been told that if he doesn't turn in Jim, who's a runaway slave, who's an escaped slave, I should say, that he's going to go to hell. And so all the time that he's had these adventures with Jim, he's actually had a religious crisis the whole time. And finally, he breaks down. He writes the letter, turning Jim in and saying where they are. And the way that Twain writes it, Huck says, I felt pure and washed clean of sin for the first time in my life. He's actually really happy that he's just turned Jim in. And then it says the critical next few lines. But then I went on thinking. And Huck thinks about the times that they've had together, the times that that Jim has saved his life, or the times in which one person takes the watch instead of the other, realizes that they love one another, right, in kind of a platonic way, and that Jim is a human being, and that the religious tradition that Huck has been taught is wrong. And the way Twain writes it, Huck says, I was in a close place and I knew it, so I had to choose between two things. And he sits and thinks a while, and he says, all right then, I'll go to hell. And he tears up the paper. And what I think about is beautiful about that moment, there's a lot that's beautiful about that moment. One of the things is that we know that this is not Huck going to hell, right? But this is Huck saving himself, right? This is Huck becoming an ethical adult. We also know that it's precisely by defying Huck's religious instruction that he's fulfilled the highest aspirations of that religion itself. So that the whole process, I think, that I've talked about here of inquiring religious traditions is not meant necessarily in defiance of those traditions, although sometimes it is, but can often be actually the fulfillment of those very traditions themselves, right? And that what Huck learned was precisely, I think, with the reason it resonated for me, it's precisely what I kind of went on my own struggle 15 years ago, I guess, when I was still working through my own issues around sexuality and religion, where I really thought coming out would be the end of my religious life. But actually, it was the beginning of it. It was the most religious thing I had ever done. Because whatever spirituality is, it must have something to do with access to love and to truth and to being truthful with one's own experience. And it was exactly that kind of rejection of what I had thought was religion that enabled what was beautiful about spirituality to blossom forth. So thank you very much.